everybody, welcome back. This is Bev.
And this is Diz.
And this is
Trigger Warning.
We said it together. Today, I have some survival stories and some Good Samaritan stories.
Ooh!
Yeah, a few of these, they only survived because of the kindness of other people's hearts.
How lovely.
So that was nice.
We really haven't had that specifically.
We have not, and that's why I did it.
Good job.
It's called Variety. Variety is the spice of life.
Indeed.
I'm going to start with a story that takes place on Valentine's Day in 2019.
Okay.
So for those who are not caught up in the Valentine's Day crush, it's February 14th, 2019. And there's a couple, Ryan Osman and his girlfriend Jessica McNeil, and they head off for a hike in Zion National Park in Utah. They chose to take a route referred to as the subway route. And according to the National Park Service, the subway route has two possible pathways. The top-down path, so I guess the trailhead starts, you know, at the top, is 9.5 miles round trip and requires a higher skill level than the other one. It includes rappelling, using 60-foot ropes, and swimming through several debris-filled deep pools of cold, cold water.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I'm like, that doesn't sound like fun to me.
No, it does not. Same.
Of course, they had me at 9.5 miles.
they had me at Utah.
The bottom-up path sounds like it might be a little bit better for, like, less skilled people. But it's still described by the National Park Service as, quote, a very strenuous 9-mile round-trip hike through the left fork of North Creek that requires route finding, hiking in ankle to knee-deep water, and scrambling over large boulders. Again, that sounds like work.
That sounds like a lot of work.
So, I don't know if this guy decided I'm going to take her on a really strenuous hike for Valentine's Day.
Nothing says I love you like...
Yeah, nothing says I love you like, scramble over a large boulder with me, baby. So, they went to this, and I'm guessing, from what I read, that didn't specify which route they took, but I'm thinking that they did the bottom up because it doesn't mention that they had ropes or anything. So they went on the bottom up route, and they'd been hiking about 3 hours when Jessica began to wade through what looked like a shallow pool of water.
Oh dear.
Her foot suddenly sank into the ground. She fell forward and both legs began to sink. Ryan grabbed her under the arms and managed to pull her free. Unfortunately, he was then stuck in the quicksand.
Ah!
His right leg sunk up to the thigh and his left up to the calf. Jessica tried to dig him out, but eventually Ryan told her to stop. The quicksand was just filling in as quickly as she could pull it back. She couldn't scoop it out fast enough. By this time, he was waist deep in the quicksand, and they knew they weren't going to get him out without help. So he told her she had to leave and hike back out on her own to get help. He's like, you got to stop digging me out trying to do this because you're just wasting energy. You're going to have to hike out of here.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So Jessica wasn't sure she could do the hike alone. It was a difficult, obviously strenuous hike. She'd always only hiked with him, especially at that skill level.
Yeah.
And she was afraid that she couldn't get help in time. So, because keep in mind, they've been at this for 3 hours already together. She said, quote, I knew the only way to save his life was to leave him, but I didn't know if he had the time left. It was the hardest thing I've had to do, the scariest thing I had to do. Ryan described the experience of getting in the quicksand like sinking into wet concrete that dries instantly. There was no other choice but to have Jessica go for help. There was no pushing or pulling or scooping that they could do to get him loose.
Right.
And there was no cell signal in the canyon. It was deep. The subway route is called that because of the way the canyon walls kind of are up above.
Almost
like a
tunnel. It's
like you're walking through a tunnel. Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So Jessica set off. A storm was rolling in. She took off.
Of course.
And sources I read said between 3 and 5 hours for her to hike out. One said 5, one said 3. So I'm saying between 3 and 5. Ryan said it snowed a couple of times while he was stranded in the canyon by himself. At one point, he woke up realizing he'd nodded off and discovered his upper body was slipping backward into the quicksand.
Oh my God.
So they had a stick that they had been trying to use to get him out. So he planted the stick in dry ground and managed to stop himself from falling backward. So he said the water was so cold he believed he would lose his leg. It was 10 hours after he got stuck that a rescue team found him.
What?
By this time, the ground was snow-covered and the temperature had dropped to 17 degrees Fahrenheit, which is negative 8.3 Celsius.
Oh my gosh.
The rescue team had to build a pulley system to extract him. And he said every tug and pull at his body caused excruciating pain in his leg. So 12 hours after sinking into the quicksand, Ryan was finally pulled free. He was hypothermic. He was exhausted. But there was another winter storm rolling in, so the team and he had to stay there overnight.
Oh my
gosh. And wait out the storm. The next morning, he was picked up by helicopter and taken to the hospital. He suffered muscle injuries in his leg but made a full recovery. Both he and Jessica were treated for hypothermia because she hiked out during the storm. And he said he wouldn't change anything about that day if he could go back. He believes it was just a freak accident. Which it is. And it's so funny, too, because you think about the memes. There are things that pop up on Facebook and stuff sometimes that say, you know, when I was a kid, I thought I'd be dealing with quicksand more frequently than I have been.
Right.
Because there was always, like, people talking about quicksand in TV shows and cartoons.
Movies
and stuff.
And yeah.
And, like, how often do you come across quicksand? But apparently, this park, they actually have warnings up about quicksand.
That is so scary.
Yeah.
Quicksand.
And they said it looked like just a shallow little pool of water. Like, it would be just covering maybe the sole of her hiking boot or
is
something.
Is there any way to save yourself if you are stuck in quicksand and you don't have a pulley system?
There were
available?
A lot of videos about it. I didn't watch them because we don't have quicksand here because we don't have sand. But
thankfully.
If I ever venture to Utah,
right,
I will find out.
Definitely not going there.
Yeah. So the next story, this one is really funny and, I mean, it's sweet. Anyway, okay, I'm just going to tell you. So if you ask most people, they will tell you that pizza is not good for you. But in this story, it saved this man's life.
Fantastic.
In 2016, a 48-year-old man named Kirk Alexander ordered from his Salem, Oregon neighborhood Domino's a few times a week. Sometimes he'd get a salad, sometimes he'd get a pizza, sometimes a sandwich, but it was like several times a week he would order from the same Domino's.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been doing this for almost a decade.
Oh my gosh.
And so they expected sometime between 11 p.m. and midnight, several nights a week, that his name would pop up on their online order list.
Uh-huh.
On May 7th, 2016, Sarah Fuller, the manager of the Domino's on Silverton Road in Salem, Oregon, was told by a couple of her delivery drivers that they hadn't made a trip to Kirk's house for a while. And they were kind of wondering what was up. They were used to going to his house.
Right.
So she checked their computer system and found out it had been 11 days since his last order.
That's not like him.
Exactly. So they were so familiar with him. They knew that he worked from home and that he rarely left his house. They also knew he had some health issues. So Sarah sent Tracy Hamblin, a longtime delivery driver, to go check on Kirk. And Tracy arrived at the house around 1 a.m. on May 8th and rang the doorbell. He noticed that the TV was on, and so were the lights in the house, but Kirk did not answer the door. Tracy tried calling him, but the phone went straight to voicemail. So he drove the 6 minutes back to the store and told Sarah, the manager, about what he found.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah called the police by a non-emergency number and asked that Tracy call 911. So she was trying to reach them through non-emergency means, but then at the same time she's like, this is not like him, call 911.
Oh, wow.
So the Marion County Sheriff's deputies arrived at Kirk's house a few minutes later. They could hear someone inside yelling for help. And they broke down the door and discovered him laying in the floor in obvious need of medical attention. He was rushed by ambulance to a nearby hospital where he recovered. The staff of Domino's sent flowers and cards and visited him while he was in the hospital.
Oh, how sweet.
And Kirk was well aware that they had saved his life. In one report, it said that he might have been too late. It might have been too late if another day had passed. They were hailed as heroes, and they were recognized by a local community and Domino's itself. Sources I read, there was nothing about what was wrong with him.
Uh-huh.
But they saved his life, so have a slice, people.
Pizza.
Pizza will save your life.
Good job, Domino's workers in Salem, Oregon.
Exactly.
And for the it's manager so crazy. To be willing, yeah. like we have to check on him and not just be like, eh, well, whatever.
Yeah. And it was obviously not about the money.
Right.
It was like, this is not him. And they knew he lived alone and they knew he had health problems.
Wow,
he
worked from home. Days.
So he didn't even have to leave the house much. So it could be, like, he ordered several times a week, so he could have fallen the day after his last order, or it could have been, like, 3 or 4 days later.
Right.
But, so, there was nothing mentioned in there about how long he'd been laying on the floor.
Yeah.
Or what his illness was or anything like that, but...
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they got recognized by, like I said, by the community, and then Domino's gave them something, I don't remember what it was, but...
A pizza party?
A pizza party would have been smart, but I don't think that was it. I don't remember what it was, but anyway... let's see, we'll go to our next story here.
Okay.
So, this is again in 2016, October 1st, 2016, in Bozeman, Montana.
Ooh, okay.
50-year-old Todd Orr woke up around 4 a.m. and got dressed for the day, grabbed a banana and his gun, and left home. I didn't think I'd ever have that sentence come out of my mouth. Got dressed for the day, grabbed a banana and his gun, and left the house. He was an avid hunter and planned a hike that day to scout for elk prior to hunting season.
Okay.
So he had plenty of experience in the wilderness between growing up in Montana, and he also had worked with the USDA, U.S. Forest Service, since 1990.
Wow, okay.
He was prepared on his hike. He carried his pistol and a can of bear spray. He said he took the pistol just in case he came across a wolf.
Wow. Montana, I'll say it again.
Yeah, Montana. In areas where grizzlies lived, it's recommended that hikers have bear spray on them and make as much noise as possible so as not to surprise one of them.
Right.
Todd was well aware of the dangers of grizzlies, and so he periodically called out shouting so that any bears in the area would know that he was there and they'd steer clear. That's usually what happens. They hear you, they wander away from you. They don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah.
So, he's walking the trail, he comes in up upon, like, a grassy meadow, it kind of opens up into this meadow, and he spots a mama bear and her two cubs about 80 yards away.
Oh no, not the mama bear and the cubs?
Yeah, and the cubs.
That would be the scariest.
And the 80 yards is 240 feet or 73 meters, by the way, I did look it up ahead of time.
Which is far away, but not for a bear.
So he said the mama bear spotted him at the same time, and they both kind of froze, just kind of locked eyes and froze. And then the mama bear took off and ran over a low ridge, and her cubs went with her. So Todd waited for a minute or two, assumed the bear wanted nothing to do with him. He continued on his hike. He headed in the opposite direction from the way the bear had gone.
Yeah.
He'd only gone a couple of dozen steps when he heard a rustling in the woods, though. And he turned to see the bear rushing at him.
Oh, no.
She was around 400 pounds and moving at about 30 to 35 miles an hour.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is 13 meters per second, roughly. Sometimes, or quite a few times, bears will kind of bluff when they charge.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of like a...
Like chicken, sort of?
Yeah, kind of play chicken. Like, it's a sign of aggression, like, to make you back down or go away.
Yeah.
And so they'll abruptly kind of stop and then just wander off, like, as a warning.
Uh-huh.
And Todd had experienced that from grizzly bears in the past. But this one apparently was not bluffing. Todd always carried bear spray with him. As an employee with the U.S. Forest Service, he was not allowed to carry a firearm. So he always had the bear spray. So even though he had his pistol, it was his instinct to use the bear spray when the mama came at him.
Uh-huh.
Mama bear. He gave her a full shot of spray, and then he turned to the side and dropped to the ground to protect himself as she slammed into him. He covered his head and neck with his hands and arms, which is exactly what you're supposed to do, because they're going to go for your neck, basically, and your face. Mm-hmm. He said the bear bit his right shoulder and arm half a dozen times before she began coughing and wheezing and ran off. So it was like a delayed reaction to the pepper spray. She got it. I mean, bear spray, but it's basically like strong pepper spray.
It took six bites before it finally kind of hit
exactly.
her.
Exactly. Yeah. For her to start.
That was
my impression of Mama Bear. So delayed reaction. She ran off. And he was like, okay, so that saved me. He knew he had puncture wounds and he was bleeding heavily, but he said his injuries were completely survivable at this point. So he was like, I just need to get out of here and get back to my truck. So he started out at a rapid pace. He made it about 800 yards, which is 731 meters or half a mile. Mama Bear showed up again.
Shut your mouth.
The way that she had run off, she ended up kind of taking a wide angle and then coming back onto the path where he was.
Oh my gosh.
And this time he didn't have any time to react before she was on top of him. So she bit into his left arm, tearing tendons, ripping away muscles. He remembered hearing the sound of his ulna, one of the bones in the arm, uh-huh. breaking. He heard it break. He cried out in pain and said this sent her into a frenzied attack. Quote, biting, clawing, shaking, and tossing me. Tossing as in, like, you've seen a dog with, like, a bone or a toy, and they kind of whip their head back and forth.
Yeah.
That's what she was doing with him. So Todd said he focused on staying quiet and still and hoped that her anger would just fade out and she'd lose interest.
How can you even think logically at that
point?
I know. You'd be like, okay, I have to be quiet.
Yeah.
I gotta chill
for... I mean, this mama, she was mad.
Wow.
So eventually her attack slowed down. She clawed at his back. She stood on him, and he could feel her claws in his side, and he forced himself not to react. Then he said she did the scariest thing possible. For about 30 seconds, she leaned down and was just kind of sniffing at the back of his neck. And he had to wait. He was like, he said he was waiting for the death bite for her to take him by the neck and kill him. He said it was the most heart-wrenching, scary sound to hear her breathing on his neck.
Yeah.
Because he knew he was screwed. If she decided to kill him, she was going to. But she didn't end up doing this. And she left him thinking he was dead. He managed to stay quiet and still enough that he said when she threw him, like, tossed him, he'd roll and then roll to kind of cover his head. So I guess he could do that much because she wouldn't realize that he was making active movements.
Right.
She wouldn't know that he didn't just land that way.
Yeah.
So, but he stayed quiet and still while she bit into him, clawed him, tearing away skin and puncturing, just crazy.
And like standing on him and...
Yeah. So he waited a minute before he finally stretched out. He was kind of in a fetal position. And he got up. He gathered his things, which had been kind of strewn everywhere, his gun, the bear spray, and he began the trek back to his truck. He said he knew it would be at least an hour to get there, but he made himself walk slowly so it wouldn't increase his blood pressure so he wouldn't bleed as badly. He made himself walk slowly to keep
what
his bleeding in the
middle.
And he knew, he knew that if she came again, he was dead.
Yeah.
He knew he couldn't survive a third attack. He stopped two or three times and would assess his injuries and keep moving. When he finally got to the truck, he had the thought in his head, I should leave a note. Because I think it was bow hunting season and he usually waited for rifle season. So that's why he was doing the hike that day.
Uh-huh.
So he was like, there might be bow hunters in the area. I should leave them a note telling them to watch out for her. And because of his injuries to his arm and his hand, he couldn't write and he was bleeding on the paper. So he had to abandon that thought.
He couldn't leave a note.
But he was that kind-hearted to think about somebody else showing up and getting killed.
How is he not in shock yet?
I don't know. So he, at this time, he took some selfies and recorded a video to show a couple of his hunting buddies. The video ended up on Facebook and other social media and went viral.
Obviously.
And there are pictures, like stills from the video and the selfies.
That.
Yeah. And his face is all bloody and he is just torn to hell. His injuries included a broken ulna, multiple punctures and tears to his upper back and shoulders, 4 punctures in the right side just above his hip, 2 severed tendons in his left forearm, and shredded muscle that required surgery to be reattached to the bone, damage to numerous nerves, and a 5-inch, 12.7 centimeter, gash along the side of his head. It took months of physical therapy to get 90% use and strength in his left arm and hand again.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, so he is considered a badass amongst
yeah.
other Forest Service workers, hikers, etc., because not only did he get attacked by a grizzly, but he got attacked by the same grizzly twice.
That is unreal. It's yeah. almost unbelievable.
And if you think about when he came into that clearing, they were 80 yards apart.
Yeah.
That he was not like he came around a corner and was up on those little babies or something.
Yeah.
He was a while, like, it was across the meadow.
Is there any, like, I don't know if you have anything else to say about it, but, like, the fact that she ran and the cubs followed her, it's like, is there a reason why? Do they think they know why she would have come back at him?
I didn't see anything about that. It's unusual. But I'm guessing if this was fall, I'm not sure when elk hunting season happens right. in Montana, but I'm assuming late summer, early fall.
Uh-huh.
So she had the bear cubs, and bear cubs stay with their mom for like about 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
So according to one of the things I read, so these weren't like brand new babies. So I'm wondering if she was in that mode of getting food for the winter. Like,
I see, yeah.
starting to prepare for winter coming. Or maybe it's just that he surprised her, and she attacked. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, they said almost, the way that it was described, the way that she had taken a separate path and just happened to end up on the trail, it made it sound like it was a coincidence that they intersected again.
Wow.
Instead of her, like,
doing
hunting him.
Purpose, yeah.
yeah. But that, like I said, that was the way it sounded. I don't know if that was actually
and they may not know
what they
anyway.
Meant. Yeah. It's not like they can go interview her. She might break them.
Well, she's teaching her cubs what to do.
Yep. You don't mess with a mama bear.
Oh my gosh. All right, quicksand and bear attacks. New fears unlocked.
Right. And it's all out west.
Yeah, so don't go.
Y'all got scary stuff going on.
Scary stuff.
We have black bears, but they're not as big.
They're so
and
cute.
And they're not as aggressive.
And they're adorable.
Okay. Now, we're going to move on.
Okay.
We're going to move on to May 25th, 2006. At around 9 a.m., Australian mountaineer Lincoln Hall, which is a cool-ass name, made it to the summit of Mount Everest, the highest mountain on Earth.
Oh, my.
Hall and his teammates took their victory photos and then began their descent from the peak. The peak of Mount Everest, in case anybody is curious, 29,032 feet.
Have mercy.
Unfortunately, at heights of 8,000 feet or higher, climbers can experience altitude sickness,
mm-hmm.
which is caused by the lower oxygen levels at higher elevations. Lincoln Hall suddenly stopped walking when he reached about 8,500 meters, which is 27,887 feet. And he told one of the Sherpas that he was tired and needed to take a nap. So he was obviously suffering from altitude sickness, a severe form of it called cerebral edema, which is basically swelling of the cerebrum
right.
in the brain. He was in what is known as the death zone, which is just below the summit. And it's usually where altitude sickness sets in because of the height. This area on Everest is a sheer, icy cliff and requires skilled use of ropes and ice axes to climb.
So you need all your faculties with
yes.
you.
The descent from the death zone to base camp normally took about 2 hours. I think this was advanced base camps, which is at like 21,000 feet. Two Sherpas stayed with Hall, who was extremely weak, and they managed to basically lower him down the mountain. Like, they were helping him down this cliff. Because he couldn't coordinate himself well enough to do it with the axes and
right.
the equipment. Due to the cerebral edema, he became more and more difficult to deal with. And could not help with the descent at all. 9 hours after they started helping him, he went limp. And the Sherpas were like, he's dead. So, this is 7:30 p.m. They're fighting daylight.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, I mean, this is up high. You don't want to get stuck up there overnight.
Right.
So they were told by the expedition leader to leave him. Most of the people who die on Everest are not recovered because the heights, helicopters can't make it up there.
Yeah.
The air is just too thin. There's just no way. So they were like, leave him. You know, you have to get down here to be safe.
You've done what you could and you have
to. I mean, 9 hours they tried to help him. And the only way to help and reduce the edema is to get him to a lower point.
Where more oxygen can get in. But
at that height, I mean, it's going to take you a while to get low enough that things are better, you know.
Well, if you think about it, he's a grown man, first of all. And even though he wasn't limp, he wasn't helpful. So it was basically almost like a completely useless arms
it was just
and legs
dead weight.
And everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And
probably fighting them at times because he just didn't understand what was going on.
And the Sherpas, I mean, one of their main things is help as much as you can, but you have to survive.
Yeah.
This is their job. They have families. They, you know, they don't do this for funsies. So they were like, in order to survive, you need to go ahead and hike back down and leave him there. So they had clear weather. And they headed back down to the base camp. So the next morning, around 7:30 a.m., a different team of mountaineers were climbing up the mountain. They were on a steep ridge line. They had clear weather. And after 7 hours of hiking and climbing, Daniel Mazur, I think is his last name, was sure that they were going to be able to summit that day. They were less than 3 hours from the peak at this point in the death zone. Less than 3 hours. That's when Daniel noticed a flash of bright yellow to his left. This is Daniel, quote, "Sitting to our left, about 2 feet from a 10,000-foot drop, was a man. Not dead, not sleeping, but sitting cross-legged, in the process of changing his shirt. He had his down suit unzipped to the waist, his arms out of the sleeves, was wearing no hat, no gloves, no sunglasses, had no oxygen mask, regulator, ice axe, oxygen, no sleeping bag, no mattress, no food, nor water bottle. I imagine you're surprised to see me here," he said. Now, this was a moment of total disbelief to us all. Here was a gentleman, apparently lucid, who had spent the night without oxygen at 8,600 meters, without proper equipment, and barely clothed, and alive. It was obvious that Lincoln Hall was suffering from severe altitude sickness. He was still alive. He was mumbling incoherently, and he was hallucinating. Other climbers had passed by him that morning and continued on their way. Because if they stopped to help somebody, they might not make it to the top.
Mm-hmm.
There is a very short window of the year and of the day to get to the top and then get safely back down to a camp. So a lot of people passed by him and didn't do anything. Daniel and his team decided that they were going to help him. So they got him back into his clothes, and they radioed down to advanced base camp, like I said, at 21,000 feet, to tell his team that he was alive, and they needed to come and help him. Hall's team leader had called his wife the night before and told her he was dead.
Oh,
so Daniel and his crew stayed with Hall for 4 hours. They saved his life. They gave him oxygen, food, water. Eventually, Sherpas from Lincoln Hall's team came back up and took over his care. By then, Daniel's team did not have time to make it to the top.
Oh, man.
The weather on Everest changes so quickly, and they couldn't risk hiking the rest of the way because a sudden storm could come in and prevent them from getting back down.
Yeah.
So even if it looked clear now, it was another 3 hours to the top. By then, it could be completely different.
And then you got to turn around and come back down.
And then you have to come back down to a safe place.
Yeah.
So, or relatively safe. So Daniel and his teammates basically sacrificed their chance to summit Everest to save Lincoln Hall. Daniel later said that Everest would always be there and they could come back to it, but Lincoln Hall only had one life. And Daniel said he could have passed by him and continued on, but he knew Lincoln Hall wouldn't survive if he'd done so, and Daniel would have had to carry that with him for the rest of his life. Lincoln Hall lost some fingers and toes and was treated for hypothermia, but he lived. He passed away in March 2012 due to cancer.
Oh my gosh.
So, and he, I was reading a little bit about Lincoln Hall. He was a pretty famous mountaineer.
Yeah.
He'd done Everest before, but hadn't been able to summit. He did, like, I think K2 and another mountain in Australia or something. Like, there were several different ones that he did. So he was well known by,
in that community,
the extreme climbers and stuff. Yeah.
Wow.
So when he passed away, everybody was like, it was like losing a legend, kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and this was, I didn't put it in here, but this was about 2 weeks after another kind of legendary mountaineer, whose name is David Sharp, I believe. And if I got the first name wrong, I apologize. I think it's, I know the last name is Sharp. He had, was up on Everest and had started having altitude sickness issues.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you've heard of Yellow Boots.
Yeah.
So Yellow Boots is a hiker that had passed away many years before and was wearing yellow hiking boots. And since they can't get the bodies off of there, he's kind of like a landmark.
Yeah.
And then this guy, I'm pretty sure it's David Sharp, sat down kind of near where he was because there was a little bit of a cave.
Uh-huh.
And people passed by him, and there was this big controversy because he ended up dying there, even though a lot of people passed him and they didn't help him. And I don't know all the details. I would have to look into it more, but there was like a camera crew that was hiking with some people, but it was their job to document their hike and their summit, so they couldn't spend time like helping. And I don't know. There was, it was a lot. But so this was about 2 weeks after that.
Oh my gosh.
And that Daniel and his teammates helped Lincoln Hall down.
Wow.
And I am at my last story, and this one is a fun one.
That, we need something fun.
Yeah, that I had to include this. So it takes place early 1990s. Dana Reinhart was in her 20s. And agreed to accompany her grandmother to an ACLU of Southern California garden party.
Oh, how lovely.
Dana's grandmother, she described her as still beautiful in her 80s and whip smart. The main honoree of the party was Ron Kovic, and he is the Vietnam vet that the movie Born on the 4th of July was based on.
Oh, okay.
So he was in a wheelchair because he had, I think, lost both legs from the knee down in Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a wheelchair ramp placed for him to go on the stage or whatever. After the speeches were over, everybody got up to mingle or to leave or whatever. Dana's grandmother got up and tripped and fell on the wheelchair ramp. And a sharp edge on the ramp cut her leg open and she began bleeding profusely.
Oh no.
Dana said that she was like, I wish I could say that I like jumped into action and helped her, and she's like, but I was sitting there with my head between my knees trying not to pass out at the sight of the blood. So a man in an expensive cream colored linen suit rushed over to help. He ordered someone to call an ambulance, and he requested a glass of water and a blanket. He pulled his jacket off, and Dana thought that he was doing this to avoid getting blood on it, because it was cream-colored linen is how she described it. So,
wow.
Expensive, you know. And he rolled up his sleeves, and to her surprise, he then took this cream-colored jacket and wrapped it around her grandmother's bleeding leg.
Aww.
And she said that you could just see the scarlet coming through that cream, and she was just like, oh my God. So, the man sat with her grandmother and talked to her, played to her vanity, complimented her legs, and he told her everything would be all right and that help was coming. And so when the ambulance got there, he walked with her along beside her stretcher and held her hand all the way to the ambulance. And as they shut the doors, he called out, "Call me, Sylvia. We'll do lunch." The man that selflessly helped Dana's grandmother was Robert Downey Jr.
What?
Yeah. So at that time, RDJ was years away from becoming Iron Man.
Right.
He was at the event with Sarah Jessica Parker, who he was dating at the time. And he was known as a playboy and a drug user.
And a drug user, yeah.
Dana didn't get a chance to thank him until years later. So after his prison sentence, which was for drug possession, and I think he was arrested for solicitation at one point as well. I can't remember. After he was Tony Stark in Iron Man, she said that she thought about writing to him when he was in prison, and she just didn't do it.
Yeah.
But having been raised in L.A., she had been trained kind of, like, the locals know, like, you're going to see celebrities.
Leave them alone.
You leave them alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't care. Like, the people who run up to him, "Can I get your autograph?" Those are usually tourists.
Right.
So, she said that she, you know, she knew this. So, when she saw him in a restaurant, she was kind of like, "I don't want, like, I know better than to go over and harass this celebrity."
Yeah.
But she was just like, "I'm going to just ignore my shyness and ignore that, and I'm going to go talk to him."
Yeah.
So, she went up to him and reminded him. She said, "I don't know if you remember this, but..." She told him about her grandmother, and she said, quote, "I just wanted to thank you, and I wanted to tell you that was simply the kindest act I've ever witnessed." So, Robert Downey Jr. stood up, he took both of her hands in his, he looked into her eyes, and he said, "You have absolutely no idea how much I needed to hear that today."
Aww.
So, that was the end of that story, and I just loved it. I was like, I love Robert Downey Jr.
I know.
I love amazing. Iron Man. I love, you know, all the Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So long, she basically was telling him, "Long before you were a hero in the movies, you were a hero to me." And that's why she wanted to write him when he was in jail, just to let him know, you know, you are a good person.
Yeah.
You've made mistakes, but you're a good person, and I have proof. But she never got over her shyness to write it, or, you know, just didn't know what to say and stuff. So, but she finally got her chance years later to thank him for being so kind to her grandmother and ruining his expensive cream-colored linen suit.
Oh, what a great story.
Isn't that great? I love that. When I read that, I was just like, are you kidding me? And I found that in Reader's Digest, and I was like, of course, I found it in Reader's Digest. I love them.
Best.
They're the best. They have the survival stories. They have the kindness stories. They have awesome jokes, dad jokes. I love them. But, yeah, Robert Downey Jr. as a superhero.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
I really like him.
Me too.
And I like hearing stories about actors who weren't jerks.
Yeah, that just sounded so Tony Stark.
Well, and especially at that time, he was known for these other things back in the 90s.
Yeah, in the 90s, he was struggling. And like I said, he was kind of a playboy, and people knew that he was into drugs and stuff. But it just goes to show, under all that, he was a kind person.
Yeah.
There were a lot of people at this garden party. He was the one that took control.
Yeah.
It's like, you go get a glass of water, you go get a blanket, you call 911, and then he helped stop the bleeding with his own expensive suit jacket.
Calmed her grandma down.
And flirted with her and complimented her, because she said that she was still beautiful in her 80s, and she was kind of vain about how she looked. And so he played to her vanity, and he was just like, "What nice legs," and like all this stuff. And she said that when the ambulance got there, he's like, "I can't believe they were taking you away from me after we just got to know each other," and things like that. And just, you know, call me Sylvia, we'll do lunch.
That's so cute.
That's so classic Hollywood too. We'll do lunch, you know. I think it would have been awesome if they'd actually gone to lunch together, but...
That would have been really cool.
She said it was funny because when they got there, her grandmother, she said she was really smart, but she wasn't up to date on celebrities.
Yeah.
She, you know, she was the Clark Gable...
Right.
You know, yeah. Generation. So she told her, she's like, "That's Robert Downey Jr. And she's like, "Oh, is it?"
Like, who's that?
And so she said that when he was working with her, when he was, like, sitting with her in the floor or whatever... she said, "My granddaughter tells me you're a pretty famous actor." And Dana was like, "Oh, crap." But, yeah, she got introduced, I guess, in an interesting way. So I love that story.
What a great way to end that.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That's why I put it at the end. I was like, above all these, I know it's like the most simple one. She probably wouldn't have died. She had a cut leg, depending on where it was cut. But from what tripping, I'm guessing just like across her calf or something like that.
Right.
But, you know, she was an elderly woman and stuff. But it was just so sweet.
And that, him.
You know.
I just want to hear great stories about him.
Yeah. I love stories about nice people.
Me too.
Nice people are nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all I've got.
That was fantastic.
Thanks.
Great stories.
Yeah. And it was fun because people didn't die in these.
Yeah. And people were nice and helped other people.
They did. They helped
people. We don't always get to see that in these stories that we research and bring to our friends.
And now we know to stay away from wheelchair ramps, quicksand, grizzly bears.
Mount Everest.
Mount Everest. You never have to worry about that with me.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
Fantastic. That's what I got.
Well done, my friend.
Oh,
well
thanks.
Done.
Thanks so much. Thanks. Yay. Let's give me some applause. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, great job.
Thanks, woo! Everybody. Thanks. Okay. All right. Well, we will catch you guys next time. I guess since we've got several episodes now, we should, like, give whoever's hanging with us a little contact info. So we do have an email. We just haven't said anything about it because we're still new. But if you want to email us and suggest an episode or give us a story, if you met Robert Downey Jr. before, I want you to email us.
Even if it wasn't at a garden party.
Yeah. I mean, if it was at a garden party, though, extra points.
Were you in quicksand?
Yeah.
Was there a bear?
Was there a bear there? Was it on Mount Everest? Did you meet Robert Downey Jr. on Mount Everest while he was stuck in quicksand?
Wow. What a story that would be.
That would be extreme.
Yeah.
So, yeah, our email address is triggerwarning, all spelled out, 411, which is the information number in the U.S., triggerwarning411@gmail.com. So you can reach out to us and say hi and tell us your stories or suggest an episode if you have a spooky or a true crime or whatever.
Or tell us what you think about the episodes that you've heard.
Yeah. But be nice because we're new.
Yeah.
And we're awesome people. You don't know yet, but we're really cool.
We're really cool.
Really, really cool.
Because people who say that they're cool are really
cool. Yeah, I guess we have to not say it.
Anyway.
Other people say it about us.
Just let us know if you guys like what we're doing, like the stories, have a story you want to share.
And I guess, like other podcasters say, rate and review us.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be a thing. And
however that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be here and hopefully keep being able to do this. So tell your friends.
Yeah.
Tell your enemies.
Family.
Your enemies might not be your enemies anymore if they like us.
Tell your dog and your cat.
Your dog and... Yeah, tell them. If you have a pet bear, maybe not them.
They might like that story.
They might, though. Yeah, they might be like, I'm pulling for the mama bear. Anyway, that was a little bit of run on. But anyway, okay, so triggerwarning411@gmail.com. We will end up with some social media accounts, and we will end up with a website, but not right now, because, again, we are still new.
We are new.
We are trying our best, though, and we thank everybody who's been keeping with us through these last 9, I think this was the 9th episode.
I think so.
Yeah. So thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye, guys.
Watch for deer.